Welcome into the Think Deeper podcast presented by Focus Press. Joe Wilkie here along with Jack Wilkie and Will Harab. And today we have a fun one, a really fun episode. I threw this idea out to the guys and just said, I don't even remember if I had a hot take or anything else like that when I said it, but I thought, man, that'd be a lot of fun to throw out. What are some hot takes? I'm Mr. Hot Take, you know, hot takes with Joe as we talk about. It's been a little while since I've really gotten into some of those, but we're going to have an entire episode.
I don't think you've had a flaming hot take in a while, I got to say.
I exhausted myself after the first year or two, so, you know,
That's right.
I toned it down maybe a little bit. But this episode is all about hot takes. It's all about some things
with Bible characters,
specifically,
right?
Yeah. With Bible characters. What do we believe about a Bible character, a Bible story that maybe goes against the grain? Things that might cause you to go, huh? That's a little odd. So we have come up with three of our own, but there's also, we got a ton of great submissions. Thank you to everybody on Facebook. Jack put that out. So thank you to everybody who participated in that, gave us some really good hot takes to discuss. Mine actually goes in with one of them, maybe two. But I had it on my own, but they just happened to put it on there, so I'm not stealing your ideas. But we appreciate the submissions. Fellas, any introductory thoughts before we jump in?
I think this might have originally been spurred by one of the Godly Young Men Discord guys. They had that question they sent in for you guys was, who has the most aura? Paul, Samuel?
That's right.
Was it Paul, Elijah, or who was the third one? Was it Samuel?
I think it was David. Samuel. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Like, and it was like, that was a fun question. Like, what do you mean, who has the most aura? You know, who has the most, like, swagger or whatever else? And so I think we kind of had some fun chewing on that one for a while. I was like, well, that's kind of a, you know, gives... Again, takes about Bible characters and where do you stand on them? We had a little bit of debate on that. So, fun question, whichever one of you sent that in.
I hope we get some good debate out of this one. Obviously, we try not to do heavy episode after heavy episode after heavy episode kind of nonstop with Think Deeper. So, this is going to be meant to lighten things up a little bit. I remember one of my favorite episodes that we ever recorded is one that probably went way under the radar, and it was our Bible Books Draft episode.
Yes.
I don't know if you guys remember that from like 2 years
ago.
That was
so much fun.
I guess it was 2 years ago now.
It just came out of my memories.
Draft time. Yeah, so that was, I don't think our listeners enjoyed it quite as much as we did, but
I think we had a lot that were like, what's a draft?
Yeah, the non-sports fan listeners were totally lost. They're like, you don't have Genesis on your top 20 books? Like, he took it. I can't. that's how a draft works.
Wait, how come the Nuggets don't have LeBron? Like, well, what? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right,
like,
yeah.
It's been taken.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this should be fun. This should be fun.
All
right. Well, Jack, you put together a really good outline. It's not just the hot takes. We got some quick hits we're going to get. Then we're going to hit our hot takes, kind of shoot those around, and then get to some of your comments, some of the things that we saw on Facebook. And we're just going to give a simple agree, disagree. But what I will say is, especially for those, make sure to join our Patreon and get your comments in, because we love to hear your hot takes. And the deep end will be given, and it will be listener comments, as always. And so if you got some hot takes you want us to react to, please get those in. Obviously, we're seeing them online. We're seeing them on Facebook, things like that. But we will have a specific show dedicated to those for the deep end that will come out later this week. So, all right, fellas, we ready to jump in?
Yeah, so that's, I came up with just a few quick hits to kind of like ease us into it, to get us rolling before we drop our own hot takes. But takes on a few different categories. One is the best person in the Bible, like the person that maybe you admire the most. And obviously Jesus is number one, so we're going to set Jesus aside on that. And yes, Jesus is the best person in the Bible. Aside from that, if you just look at somebody who's like, that's the guy or that's the woman, who do you have on that one?
I'll go first here. This is a pretty easy one for me. I think Joseph is the
thanks, man.
The study of Joseph. Did I take Joseph? Oh no, I guess that's
no,
your name.
He,
that's
no.
Why. Yeah, that's right.
Joseph's the best person. I just admire him.
I so
yeah,
too.
That's right. The study of Joseph, where you see all the things that happened to him. You see him, you know, kind of be the spoiled child. You see the pure betrayal from his brothers. You see him rise to power. I think it's an interesting study on masculinity to see basically everywhere Joseph goes, he thrives and he succeeds and he, you know, works
with everybody else.
Even
up,
in prison. Yeah, exactly. Even in prison, he, you know, gets to where he has authority in prison. And obviously we know what happens after he gets released from prison. And I think the study I think the section of scripture where his brothers come back and he kind of test them to see, like, have they changed? What's their character like? How's their heart now? Because they're the ones that betrayed me years ago. Like, I know he's kind of recognized as one of the guys that doesn't really have anything negative said about him in the Bible. There's not really anything that you could say that was negative. I love Joseph. I think his story, again, we are introduced to him at 17. We get basically his entire life. The fact that he gets the chance, if he wants to take revenge on his brothers after their father Jacob dies, and he chooses not to. The fact that he has complete power and control over them when they come to Egypt, doesn't take his opportunity to take vengeance. Joseph's just a really, really excellent role model, I think, for guys. Joseph is my answer pretty easily there.
Yeah, I get that. Mine would be, I think I know what Jack's is. I think he's going to go with Moses personally. But mine's going to be the second guy in the Bible that...
I think Jack's going Abraham, but go ahead.
Maybe, yeah. Okay, Daniel is mine. The other guy that we don't have anything written poorly about him, same concept. He's kind of Joseph 2.0 in a lot of ways, rising to power. He's in captivity, obviously going to Babylonian captivity, away from his people. There's just so many parallels between the Joseph and Daniel story. And I think Daniel... from start to finish, early life to later life, you know, you see him after, I mean, he's been through a complete regime change. So he leaves his land of Israel, goes to Babylon, then there's a regime change toward Persia. And even in that, we see him getting thrown into the lion's den later in life. And he's still faithful all the way through. He surrounded himself with good friends. He is the prayer three times a day, choosing the vegetables right over. I mean, just over and over, it's like, man, there's a self-control. There's a goated move. As
Daniel was the first anti-seed oil guy.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what it was. That's what he was doing.
Yeah, no big pharma either. Yeah, he's, you know, just stick to the ground. But no, I think Daniel to me is, I love his story. And there's not a bad beat in the entire thing. I'm like, oh man, wish. With Joseph, there almost is. I agree with you that there's no discernible sin. But there's also like, okay, the jealousy, maybe he's a little spoiled type of thing. I don't know. And then he's kind of angry towards his brothers. He's got every right to be. But he handles it incredibly well. Joseph is one of my favorite characters. But with Daniel, it's just literally there's not a bad beat in the entire book. So, or anything negative, really, which is incredible. Yeah. But Jack, how about yours?
Yeah, you got me with the Moses one.
Yes.
So that's Abraham was a good choice. Moses, you know, there's... other ones that you don't get as much of, but we've been doing 2 Kings for the Devo, so Elisha. I mean, Elijah, you could say there's, okay, he kind of had the moment of, oh, woe was me kind of thing. Elisha, just one after another. I mean, just taking people down, doing the right thing, miracles, everything. But Moses obviously has his flaws. We have more of his life than anybody in the Bible except for Jesus. And maybe more, if depending on like how you lay it out. Obviously, the Gospels overlap a little bit. And so, Moses has his mistakes, his sins, the things he does wrong. But
well, and his insecurities that you're introduced to, you know, at the burning bush.
The growth. Yeah. I mean, you see him grow out of that. And the other thing is, like, if I had to deal with those people for 40 years... And I like slipped one time, that, okay, you know, like that's pretty good. that's pretty solid. So, again, somebody that grew, somebody that took on hard things, somebody that, made such a difference. So, I'll go with Moses on him.
I got a quick thought on that. When we think about harshest punishments in the Bible, we think about Uzzah being killed right away, right?
Yeah.
For touching the ark. We think about kind of David and Bathsheba, the son that arose from that, him being killed. I think one of the most underrated, harshest punishments in the Bible is Moses not being able to enter the promised land because of his disobedience. Like, it was pretty much a, you know, I'm not going to say one strike, but God basically, all right, that's it. You now, the land that I have been telling you about since the burning bush, that you have been thinking about, that you are leading these people towards, that's it. You don't get to go in because you decided to, you know, essentially, you know, disobey. And
right.
So, yeah, as far as a harsh punishment goes, underrated because he wasn't like killed or anything. I think that's one of the harsher ones that we see in the Bible from God. It's very Ananias of fire is the other example that comes to mind right away. But.
And well, it really trains you of like the God's holiness that he basically, you know, set himself up as I'll be the guy who do this. You want me and Aaron to do this for you. Like,
right.
That's a line you don't get to cross is, you know, elevating yourself up there to God. And he again, in all those years, he did a really good job of keeping those things separate, staying on the right side of the line, except for one bad day. And you know,
it's kind of a hero's journey. You know, like the story is incredible where you grow up in Pharaoh's house, then you kill the Egyptian, right. You know, and to be with your people, you flee to Midian, the burning bush, to come in, I'm not a good speaker, I'm freaked out. And then he leads the people out. Like, it's just such a good hero's journey story of a man overcoming all his flaws, overcoming his issues, not perfect by any means, but just steady, solid, you know, and just the journey all the way through. So that's a good take.
All right, so for our quick hits, we're going to have to go a little quicker on these. The other thing is, I realized I was on the wrong microphone, so I apologize. My audio is not as crisp as I usually would like it to be, but at least I don't have to have that thing in my face the rest of the time. So, if you're listening, hope you can hear me okay. The worst person in the Bible. And again, we're going to set Satan aside, okay?
Go ahead, Joe. You go first on this one.
Jezebel. I think Jezebel is my answer. Just because ruthless, brutal, just a disgusting person through and through. Ahab is not good because he doesn't stand up to her. Ahab is just a weak man, but she is, you read some of her stuff, and by the time that she's, you know, eaten by dogs, it's like, yeah, you got what's coming to you type of thing. So consistently, she's long enough in the story. That's the difficult thing, is there's some really bad people in the Bible, but man, it pops up for a time. You know, a king, so-and-so from somewhere, Eglon comes to mind, whatever it may be, right? Not good people. She has long enough story arc to really get to see, like, wow, this is a terrible person. She shows up time and again without a single good word. So, yeah, I would say Jezebel.
We'll make this one real quick, because Jezebel was my answer as well. It's almost like, Joe, to your point about the amount of information we read about Jezebel, it's almost like the biblical authors were giving us extra insight into, like, okay, here's just how bad of a person. Like you said, it could have been a blip in the story, but, like, no, we get details about how she ordered the execution of the prophets and even the Naboth's vineyard thing, like... I said it was going to be quick. Jezebel was my answer as well. Obviously, Judas is kind of low-hanging fruit there as well, but I went with Jezebel. Jack?
Yeah, Jezebel. There's so many in the kings, the judges that you could go to.
Even Jezebel's husband, Ahab, is a good choice, too.
He was awful. Ahab was a loser.
Yeah, I almost went with him. I'm going to go with Caiaphas. Obviously, all the Pharisees, chief priests, scribes, but I cannot get over the quote after Jesus heals Lazarus from the dead. And, like, well, we're just going to have to put him to death, you know, because there's too much of a stir. And, like, now he's doing miracles. He's raising people from the dead. We can't have that anymore. Like, you didn't stop to evaluate at that point that this might be the good guy? Like, it's just unbelievable. And obviously that's they carry pick. Through with the sham trial, all that. So I'm going to go with him. All right. This is a little bit of a fun one. The best hang in the Bible. The person you would most like to just hang out with. Oh, man. That's hard. Elijah, Elisha, there's some funny stuff in their things. And so again, I'm very much in the Kings in the Bible study right now. And so, recency bias gets you on that one. I'm going to say that, and then I'm going to pass it off. And if a better one comes to mind, I'll pass it to you guys.
Nice. Will?
I guess I'll go next. I had two answers down. I'm going to save my other answer cause it's going to come up later. I'll go with Barnabas.
Yeah,
son of encouragement, right?
Nice. I feel like he's a
pretty fun guy to hang out with. Obviously, we know he was a very hard worker in the first century church and a very prominent guy. The encouragement angle is what I went with there. I'm sure there's some better answers. That's what I went with there. Joe?
Mine are kind of lame. I had two. Paul, rather, and David. And for different reasons. Paul's a world traveler. You get the sense he's got a lot of world experience. I think it'd be incredibly fun to pick his brain on what all he saw and did.
I was curious on Paul because that came to mind, but like Paul is also so intense.
But that, exactly. I thought about that as well. As a hang, it's like, man, I'd hate for like you or, you know, what he does in Galatians 2 to Peter. Like, I don't want to be on the receiving end of that. So I thought about that. But then I also thought about David from like, he's a musician, he's a shepherd, he's a warrior, he's got great stories. What's it like to kill Goliath? He also is very intense. So from a fun stories perspective, if I was just chilling around the campfire and he's telling war stories, like that'd be great. From a buddy, Barnabas is a great choice. I mean, you'd want somebody that's a little more like the Apostle John walking with Jesus. You could tell he seems like a pretty nice guy rather than he's going to rip your head off, you know, like Paul. So,
hey, the Sons of Thunder, though. I mean,
that's true. That's a good point. So, that's a good point.
Yeah. I don't know. I'll stick with my answer on that one, but. That's an interesting one. Best person to just hang out with for a bit. To go grab a Coca-Cola with, to say that correctly. All right, most annoying person in the Bible. Not necessarily a bad person or you know, in the evil, but somebody who annoys you. Joe, I think you're up on this one.
You're going to love my answer. Jacob annoys the snot out of me.
I knew it. I knew you
were going to go. Here we go. Jacob annoys me. But the first guy that came to my mind, I did that just to razz you, though. He does annoy me. Saul... I'm reading through Saul. It's just recency bias. King Saul. Guy drives me nuts.
Good
you
take.
Know, it's like David has a chance to kill him, comes out of the cave. Hey, here's a piece of your cloak. I didn't kill you. I'm so sorry. And then like two chapters later, he's got the spear next to his head and David steals the spear. And it's like, hey, I could have killed you. Okay, I'm so sorry. And he goes back home like, okay, guy, how many times, you get the sense, like the more you read it, I think he genuinely was what we would call bipolar today. Like he is, or multiple personality, or schizophrenic, where you have like the hallucination. The guy seems nuts, because obviously he's getting David to come in and play music to kind of calm the evil spirits, which is just dysfunctional, is kind of the term.
Are you of the opinion that his humility at the start was fake, or do you think he was actually being humble?
I think he's a wuss. I think David was a humble man, but David was a warrior go-getter still kinda, at the heart. Yeah. He's a go-getter. Whereas Saul was the
"it's over, we're so back" meme. You know, like when he wins a battle, like yeah, I'm the man, and then anything goes bad, like oh man, it's terrible.
Exactly,
you know?
He just drives me nuts. All of the. It's so up and down with him. He gets a victory, and then he goes and blows it. Or, like, my guys can't eat until we get to secure this battle. And this guy's, like, dying type of thing. Like, you idiot. You idiot. Yeah. What are you doing? So King Saul, to me, is just the most annoying guy.
Good choice.
Good. Mine is a very interesting one. Solomon actually annoys me.
Really?
And the reason is because the guy had everything you could possibly want and still chose to turn away from God. I mean, the guy, God comes to him in a dream. He asks for wisdom. He gets wisdom. He's richer than we can. I think he was wealthier than we could even imagine today. Like even with guys like Elon Musk, like the wealth and power that Solomon had, and then for him to throw it all away just because he couldn't stand up to one of his 1,000 wives. Like, and I know there's a little bit of debate on whether or not he came back around to God at the end of his life based on Ecclesiastes, all that. There's still just an element of like, man. You literally had everything you could possibly want in life. God gives you wisdom. God spoke to you, like all these things, and you still couldn't get out of your own way. So, yeah. A bit of an unorthodox answer, but Solomon has always kind of gotten on my nerves a little bit.
That's a good one. I'm going to throw in, as an honorable mention, Samson. It's just like, stop making stupid choices, dude. I mean, like, you are your own worst enemy over and over. But my most annoying is Laban. Every time I read through Genesis, it's like, what a weasel.
He's a scumbag.
dishonest. Don't be like Laban. All right, so those are our quick hits. Again, we'd love to get your comments on best person in the Bible, Jesus excluded, worst person in the Bible, Satan excluded, best person to hang out with, and most annoying person in the Bible to you. All right, now we're going to get to our hot takes. Who wants to go first on hot takes?
You go for it.
I think you do, Jack. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I guess we're back to my turn, isn't it?
Go ahead and get into the Jacob thing. Go ahead.
I feel like I've done that before, so I was going to sit on that unless we need more time. We're way too hard on Peter. Peter and some of the people in our comments had some thoughts on this as well, that he's the one that got out of the boat. And we can all say, oh, he took his eyes. Yeah, but he got out of the boat. He's one of two people in Earth history to walk on water. That's pretty cool, you know, because of the faith that he did have. But the other one, the denial of Jesus, and right before that where he says, I would die for you. And we're like, oh yeah, right, Peter, when push came to shove, he denied him. That's not entirely true. He got a sword out and was ready to fight to the death and you know, cut the guy's ear off. And
One of the only ones that we know of.
Yeah, I mean, like, where other people were scattering and all these things were happening. Because the other thing is, Peter was there to deny him. Where was everybody else? Peter was at least still following, and so, you know, and then not only that, you get the, well, Peter just sticks his foot in his mouth. Peter's brash. Peter's bold. Like, Peter's the opposite of me. I'm the guy who doesn't speak up, but I admire that quality to a degree of he's willing to look stupid to speak up. Nobody else is saying anything. At least he's taking a shot, you know?
It's so funny, Jack. The first thing I have written down for my hot take, I think Peter, as an example of biblical masculinity, is one of the top guys in the Bible.
There you go.
From a biblical masculinity perspective, and this, so I guess it's kind of lame that we both have a similar hot take to start, but that was the first thing I had, is that I think Peter is one of the top examples of biblical masculinity in the entire Bible. The thing about putting his foot in his mouth or whatever, Peter was willing to say specific things as opposed, you know, I'm big and all three of us are big on, say things that are specific and don't be vague. Don't be generic. Right. Don't be ambiguous. Don't make people try to guess. Well, what is he actually? No, just say it like it is. Say what you mean it. Yes, you may say the wrong thing. You may have to go back and retract and apologize, all those things. Man, Peter absolutely embodied that. As you see in the New Testament time and time again, he said stuff that, you know, Jesus responds with, get behind me, Satan. He also says things that was just an absolute Shohei Ohtani out of the park hit. Like, just perfectly well said. The getting out of the boat thing, like, he was the only one bold enough to climb out of the boat and walk on the water. Obviously, there is the kind of that character arc story of his denial of Christ after, as you said, he pulled his sword out. But chose to deny Jesus, and then the rebound from that to not kind of dwell in his mistake and kind of wallow. I mean, he could have followed the same path as Judas did, as other biblical smarter people than me have pointed out before, and yet it was the opposite. He returned to preach the first gospel sermon. All those things that we all know about Peter. I just think we don't always look at him as a great example of masculinity. And I think he's one of the best examples of masculinity in the entire Bible for all of those reasons. Again, the recovery from his mistakes, the willingness to, you know, kind of admit when he was wrong, the Cornelius. I mean, there's just so much I could keep going on. And so that is not to tack on. That is my own hot take that
I like the masculinity point.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I like both of these. These both check out. I think we are too hard on him personally. He gets a bad rap for the denial and things like that, and yes, for being a little, I just look at it as bold. Matthew 16, upon this rock I build my church. No, it's not Peter, of course, it's his confession, but it is the confession from Peter, and he's the one with the keys of the kingdom to some degree. He gets to preach the gospel to the Gentiles in Acts 10. He's the one with the first gospel sermon in Acts 2 at Pentecost. So,
well, in the John 6, where, you know, who else are we going to go? You have the words of eternal life. Like, man, just a great line.
He seemed on it, and I'm not saying the rest weren't, but he seemed on it earlier than everybody else to some degree of like, man, where else am I going to go?
He was all in. Yeah.
He was all in, exactly. And the other ones you see kind of question, and I'm not saying he didn't at times, but he very much seemed consistently on it.
There's a lesson in this, and some people have pulled this out before, but like the thing that is your greatest weakness is very closely tied to your greatest strength. The things where you can go wrong is also where you can go very right. And so it was the boldness that led to some of the errors, some of the foot in his mouth moments, but it's also the boldness that gives him that where he's just standing up saying things other people won't. And he's the guy in Acts 2 and in Acts 3, and I mean the first 11, 12 chapters in Acts, you know, where he's just one after another knocking them down and, you know, doing a great job. And so, yeah, this is going to be a consistent theme for me, and I won't make all my hot takes this way. I think we're just way too hard on people in the Bible in general, and we really like kind of slamming them. And we can learn from their mistakes. We can learn from his denial, from their sins, from the things they did wrong, for sure. I'm not saying that. But it's one of those, like, as the kids used to say 10 years ago, put some respect on his name. You know, like, this is Peter we're talking about here.
Respect on that
He
chip.
Did a lot of good things.
Millennial line right there.
I know. It's, well, what would the kids say these days? I'm out of touch.
Oh, man.
He's him,
Riz.
You know?
He's him. Blazing him.
But no, yeah. It is one of those, like, let's take it a little bit easier before we... Okay, I'm just going to riff on this just for half a second. I just did that Chosen video, Why I Hate the Chosen. They have the apostles refer to John the Baptist as Creepy John. And so to my point of, like, we're a little too loose with our criticisms and our the ways we talk about people. Like, this is John the Baptist we're talking about. Little old me, does not get to take shots at John the Baptist. You know, there's this great story in hockey of the two biggest rivals in hockey, the Avalanche and the Red Wings. And the rookie hotshot on the Red Wings starts trash-talking the Avalanche's captain, and one of his teammates grabs him by the shirt, pulls him down, sits him on the bench, and says, "You don't get to talk to Mr. Sakic." Like, yes, we hate them. Yes, they're our rivals. You don't get to talk to that guy. He's a Hall of Famer, and you're a nobody. John the Baptist is a Hall of Famer, and I'm a nobody. Peter is a Hall of Famer,
Stephen
and I'm
a
nobody.
Smith, there's levels to this.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, you know, and so the next time you get up to take a shot, oh, there's Peter with his foot in his mouth, like... Take it easy. So
all
anyway,
non-sports fans are like, what is going on here? What is this?
Right, yeah.
I didn't get into the rivalry or anything like that, but the concept of...
No. I'm talking Stephen A. Smith.
Right. Yeah. But, all right, Joe, you give us a hot take. What do you got? Some stories make you laugh. Some bring tears. And some stay with you forever. Ink by the Barrel by Joe May is a powerful collection of true stories from small-town Arkansas. Stories of faith, heartbreak, healing, and the kind of humor only real life can write. From wild childhood adventures and front porch wisdom to hard lessons in heartbreak, trauma, and healing, Joe opens up with raw honesty and just enough southern humor to keep you smiling through the hard parts. It's about faith that holds you together when the world falls apart, grace that shows up in unexpected places, and finding joy even in the middle of the mess. If you love stories that are funny, moving, and deeply rooted in God's love, this one's for you. Get your copy of Ink by the Barrel by Joe May on Amazon today.
My hot take, and I know you and I disagree on this because we talked about it. For anybody that's on the Patreon that listens to our class, they will know this one when we talk about Jonah.
I am waiting here.
I think Jonah died. I think Jonah physically died. I don't think that it was just down in there.
I wondered if this was going to come up.
Yes, I think he... as you look at Matthew 12 and the sign of Jonah and such, I don't think it demands that he had to have died, but I think you read Jonah 2. I just had this pulled up. It's like, I don't know. Seems pretty shut case for me, open and shut type of thing. Caught in my stress, the Lord answered. I know Jack is going to bring up Psalm 69, so I know where he's going with it. But cried for help from the depths of Sheol. He heard my voice, for you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the sea, and the current engulfed me, and your breakers and billows passed over me. Now think about this. You're in the Mediterranean Sea. You're in the middle of nowhere. You are going down, as he says. And nevertheless, I would look again to your holy temple. It seems a little bit odd. Expelled from your sight. Water encompassed me to the point of death. People say, well, that's, and actually it's soul of death, not point of death. The great deep engulfed me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I descended to the root of the mountains. Exactly how deep are we going here? Now, you could say this is just, you know, typical, I don't know, poetic terminology. The rest of the book doesn't read as such. I know this is just a, again, it almost sounds a lot like Psalm 69, but the rest of the book doesn't necessarily read around it. I descended to the roots of mountains. The earth was, with its bars, was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit. Well, what is the pit being referred to? Or corruption is the other reading of that. O Lord, my God, while I was fainting away, I remembered, Lord, my prayer came to you into your holy temple. I read that. I think he physically died. And I saw this. Somebody posted this on Facebook as well. They believe the same. But that's something that I taught in class. Jack and I already disagree on this one. So I know that. He does not believe that. And I'm not like putting everything. I'm not betting the farm on that. But on the other hand, I think all of that terminology and then using it later as a you know, looking toward the resurrection and going into the mouth of a, I think he was revived in the mouth of the beast or in the belly of the beast, excuse me, the sea creature, whatever it is. So by the time he gets spit up on dry land, I think he is alive. But if you're going down to the mountains and weeds are wrapping around your head and death, the soul of death encompasses you, I don't think you are alive at that point. So that's my take. What are your thoughts?
Jack's got to go.
I want to see yours before I cross-examine here.
Yeah. So this had come up maybe a year or so ago in a class, I think, that Joe taught. Maybe. I can't remember for sure. It doesn't convince me. If I had to pick a side, I would say I don't think he died. As somebody who has not studied it near as much as you have, Joe, I'm trying to remember, are there any other examples? So basically what you're saying is that Jonah was resurrected from the dead. Like, we kind of have to put him in the same group as Lazarus Christ, obviously. Is there anybody else, man, unless I'm just blanking, in the Old Testament that was literally resurrected from the dead?
Some people think Job's
Elijah and Elisha did resurrections.
Right, okay. So, like, but like civilians, like they raised, right, like regular people. Okay.
Right.
Yeah, again, I think I would have, I mean, even verse 10, so the Lord spoke to the fish and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Like, there's, so you're saying, Joe, before he was spit up on the dry land, he was already resurrected within the belly of the fish. Obviously, I think the strongest argument maybe is the parallel to Christ. I'm not fully convinced. I guess I could be swayed either way, but if I had to pick a side, I would say I don't think he died in there.
I don't have a side on this, actually. I'm in the camp of it doesn't matter, and I think
agree.
It's one of those, like, wouldn't it be cool? Well, okay, kind of, but, like, there is the Psalm 69 thing with very similar language. Save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in deep mire. There is no foothold. I have come into deep waters. A flood overflows me. And there's a lot more of, like, that death language, very similar to what Jonah's prayer says. And so I say that not to say that proves it, just to say somebody can talk that way, it doesn't mean they died. The other thing being, well, a couple things. One, if he was raised from the dead, I would like to think that if he came back from the dead, his behavior would be better. He's not a changed man. And obviously he came back from a very threatening situation, but he gets spit out and is still just as begrudging as he was before. So I don't see the change I would expect to see from a dead man. I think with the typology of it, yes, Jesus, there's a relationship to that, but typology is not the same thing happened in both cases. It's
sure.
Echoes, shadows, you know, like a version of it happened in one place or another. So I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm saying it didn't have to happen. We don't know that it happened. And so I'm ambivalent. I'm just in the middle on it. I don't really, one way or another.
Yeah, I could see that. The difference between Psalm 69 and this, though, is he literally was in the water. David is writing it as though, you know, he's using water to describe different scenes. Jonah literally was in the water.
It is
going
really
down.
Hard to imagine how somebody could be in the stomach of a fish underwater for 3 days and live. That part is true. I will give you that. Like, just from a literal perspective. But
yes, it comes around to this is fun to, you know, discuss and kind
of
kick
around. A lot of this doesn't really matter.
Right. It has no bearing on anything, whether he died or did not die. And that is a good point that you'd like to think he was resurrected. I had the thought, like, you see these people that die in the operating room and, like, hover above. They talk about hovering above and kind of going back down. And you wonder, like, is that what took place where you're kind of dead, but you're not, you know, like, you are something conscious? You know what I mean? Like, okay, you weren't dead for 3 days, but you were at the point of death, to the point where, like, your spirit is leaving your body. I don't know. It's all conjecture. I don't think it matters. But
let me go ahead and share my next one. It's in a similar vein. It's one of those that I am not at all going to die on this hill. I'm probably 55, 45, 60, 40 in one direction. But I think if I had to bet the farm on it, to use Joe's phrase, I do think Paul was married at some point. I know there's a lot of debate on that. I'll just kind of lay out the case for. So the Bible, the New Testament never explicitly says that he was a member of the Sanhedrin, other than Acts 26, verse 10, where it talks about him casting his vote, you know, against certain people. And not a lot of other things that, you know, if he was not a member of the Sanhedrin, you know, what else would that entail as far as the vote goes? And then obviously their history would tell us that you could not be a member of the Sanhedrin if you weren't married. Add to it, if Paul was, you know, Pharisee of Pharisees, zealous, you know, studied under Gamaliel, the odds that he would not be married at any point it is incredibly unlikely that he would get to that point in his Judaism and his faith and his, you know, Pharisaical walk, so to speak, and not be married. There's obviously, okay, so what about post-conversion? Philippians 3, verse 8, he talks about he's lost all things for the sake of Christ. And so there's a couple of examples I'll get into here in a second. Or I guess options of what could have happened. But then the other thing is, with the amount of Paul's writings on marriage, I understand he was fully inspired by God and all those things. There is still a human element to his writing. He seemed to understand marriage in a very intricate way that I don't think he was just like, all right, God, I'm not an expert on this, so please just take the wheel for this, for Ephesians 5. You do a little bit extra inspiration here. Like, he seemed to know a lot. I mean, the mystery he talks about in Ephesians 5, obviously he writes a great deal about it in 1 Corinthians. For a guy to have never been married, to write in that much detail about marriage in the New Testament, even, you know, albeit inspired by God, I think it makes more logical sense to say that he was married. So obviously, what options do we have if that is the case? Option one, which I think is the most likely, is that he was married at some point and she passed away, that he was a widower. That would speak to the 1 Corinthians 7, to the unmarried and widows, they should remain as I am. A lot of people take that to just mean single. I think it's very plausible, based on translations and such, that could just mean he was a widower as well, that she had died. There's people that would argue he was married and then once he converted, she basically left him. And, you know, told him to go his own way. That's where the Philippians 3:8 passage would come in, where he said, I've lost all things for the sake of Christ, including his wife. I don't love that one near as much. Those are kind of the main two options that I think make the most sense. But again, to sum it all up, I think my opinion is that it's a pretty high likelihood that at least at some point Paul was married, based on, again, the Sanhedrin thing, the Pharisee, what he was as a Pharisee, and then all of his writings in the New Testament. So that's my somewhat hot take. What are y'all's thoughts on that?
That's maybe the hottest take yet, because so many people have built. We did a whole episode on people going, yeah, you know, well, marriage doesn't matter. Like Paul.
On it, yeah,
yeah. Right. Exactly. Right. Like, don't say that people need to get married because Paul did. You know, like, well, but if he did, and yeah, so I think it's interesting. I think the case is, it, you know, as you're kind of saying, it's not something you can say, yeah, he was, but it's a very good case.
I'm like 60-40, I think, is what I would have it at.
The only thing I'd say is, why would he not mention that he was married at some point? Why would he not have ever, I think I agree with you. I'm probably 60-40 that, you know, he, I don't know.
Maybe Okay. 50. I thought y'all might be in the
other way. Maybe I'm 50-50 on it. Yeah. I go back and forth on this. I've heard these arguments before, and I think those are compelling cases or compelling reasons for why that might be the case. But I also, like, when he talks about 1 Corinthians 7, wish all men were as me, you get the sense that he's been given a special ability to not have that, you know, but he realizes, like, people are going to burn with passion. And it's possible that after his marriage, he's just done. He swore off it. I mean, that is theoretically possible.
Right.
But some of the way he talks about in 1 Corinthians 7 kind of seems to indicate there's more singlehood than not. So, and then the fact that he never does mention a wife in terms of, I've lost all things, you know, I was, because he goes into the lists a couple times of,
well, like you're saying, Hebrew, he doesn't give Hebrews, the details.
You know,
the,
and so he gives enough details to know what tribe he's from, to know, you know, his background. He never mentions a wife. So that would be my knock against it, maybe.
My two responses to that would be, one, we don't really get a ton of, you know, past insight from Paul other than his past sins, right? Like, he calls himself the chief sinner, obviously. He talks about, you know, the tribe he was from and all those things and his, you know, the fact that he was a Pharisee. There's not a lot of, like, lore, background lore for Paul that he volunteers anyway. So that would kind of, like, it doesn't seem, that's not really his style. The other thing is, and this would, I guess, be the most, this would kind of fall in the camp of, he was married maybe for a short time and then she died, maybe in childbearing, whatever it is. I have a really hard time getting around the fact that he would be such an outlier Pharisee if he wasn't married. Like he would, that just really did not happen back then. And so that, I think the strongest case is he was married and she passed away at a very young age. You know, again, can I come down rock solid on that? No, of course not. And does it ultimately matter? Probably not. But Jack, like you said, man, you say, hey, marriage is better than singleness. Immediately, everybody's first response is, well, Paul, what about Paul? Is Paul single? Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
The cultural reading of this, we look at it like, well, of course, some people are just single. That's not how it worked back then. Like,
not
you,
at all.
You just got married. You know, like, that's, it would be to assume somebody was unmarried their entire life. I'm sure there were people who went about that way. And I'm sure that, you know, there's people in the Bible where their wife is not mentioned, or his wife, you know, whoever it may be. It seems unlikely, you know, he would be a very slim minority. And it's not like today where people regularly go their whole lives. And so,
interesting. If we did not hear about Peter's mother-in-law, like, the Bible doesn't mention that Peter's married either, but we know that he was based off of that. A slim little reading. So, yeah, this is a great take.
Yeah.
It's a great take.
All right.
I think it's Jack, your turn.
Is it your turn? Maybe one more round of them before we get to audience hot takes. Should I do the Jacob one? I've done the Jacob one before, I believe. I know Joe doesn't.
We'll have some good debate.
Well, I know I did it in a Bible class one time because that was fun. And I had everyone raise their hands, like, who thinks Jacob was a scoundrel? Who thinks he was a good guy? And then at the end of it, I tried to raise of hands.
It's fun. If you literally Google, like, villains or, you know, annoying people or villains in the Bible, his name will come up on the AI overview.
Right.
Yeah.
For good reason.
Right. Anyway. Well, by the time I got to the end of that class, I had, okay, raise your hand now. Do you think he's a good guy? And I had won over, I don't know, at least half of the people who thought he was a scoundrel. So one of the things, he's portrayed as a weak mama's boy. Let's start right there. You know, oh, he's just, you know, a soft guy, stays at home. He wrestled God all night long. That's pretty hard to do. You know, to wrestle anybody all night long and come out with the victory, like, this was very clearly a strong guy. He was not out of control like Esau. You know, he had some of the home tendencies, but a lot of this case rests on a certain word. So Joe's going to get in here and shoot back, but I got to pull up the verse here.
Okay, and while you're pulling that up, is your take simple? Like, what is your take? Is your take simply that Jacob is not as bad as we make him out to be, or that Jacob was actually a great guy?
I think he was a good guy. I would say he's a good guy. I think a lot of the things that are blamed on him, you know, deceiving Isaac is like, yeah, Isaac and Esau were both in sin in that chapter, and it was Rebekah's idea to do the deception. As far as taking Esau's birthright, like, I'm sorry, if your brother's an idiot and just gives it to you, that is not an Jacob problem. That's an Esau problem. Genesis 25:27. It's very weird that it's translated this way. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Let's see.
Mild is what New King James has.
Yeah, mild. If you go to Job 1:1, same word, There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless, same word, Job 1:8, a blameless and upright man, Job 2:3. Like, through all throughout Job, that's used as a blameless or guiltless man, is how the NAS translates it. It's very closely related to the same word that is used for Noah, blameless in his generation. For some reason, the translators decided, hey, this one time we're going to change that to he was a wimp. You know, he was just a quiet guy sitting at home. Like, no, he was the same word that was used for those other guys as a blameless man. I think that's a big deal. I think, I mean, that's not just Job. It's in the Psalms, Psalm 37:37, mark the blameless man. Proverbs, men of bloodshed hate the blameless. It's perfect in the book of Song of Solomon. Why is, like, if you look up all of the, in fact, I've got it right in front of me, all of the times that is used in the Old Testament, it's complete, blameless, integrity, guiltless, or perfect, except this time where he was a peaceful man. I think that's significant. That's a word you have to get around and say, why do they translate it differently when he's the good guy in this story? And because the other thing, part of this case is, Genesis is the book of family division and brother against brother. You've got Cain and Abel, you've got Isaac and Ishmael, you've got Joseph and his brothers, you've got all of these divisions, and in all of them, there's the good guy and there's the bad guy. Who's the bad guy in this one? It's Esau. Who's the good guy in this
one?
Yeah,
I'd agree with that.
It's Jacob.
I'd agree.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Let me ask this before Joe goes. And I hear what you're saying, and I mean, I think you make a compelling case personally. I think my take would be he's not as bad as we make him out to be. I do think there's so much in there about him being a deceiver, about him being, you know, kind of having that streak within him of kind of, even if, because what I always go to, Jack, and I know you mentioned that it was Isaac and Esau that were in the wrong here, but his outright lies in chapter 27 of, yes, I am Esau. Like, I know we talked about righteous deception before. Like, that one's hard for me to get around.
That is where you have to have that conversation where it's like Abraham deceived, Isaac deceived, Jacob deceived, the Hebrew midwives deceived. Like, that, there was so much of that happening in the book of Genesis. And if you're staunchly on the it's wrong every time, then yeah, then you're going to hold that against him.
Yeah. Joe, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm looking up the BDB. Sorry, not BDAG. That's the Greek one. The Hebrew lexicon, complete, used 10 times.
Yeah, complete is what New King James
perfect
has.
Perfect in beauty of physical strength, so it could be talking about his physicality. Who knows? No, I mean, that is a compelling piece to this. My struggle is, going back to birth, supplanter. You know, he's going to come out, he's going to supplant him, and he just lives up to the name. Like, it just seems, I don't like
his shady... Why is that wrong?
I don't like his shady business dealings. Like, him, instead of giving to his brother, which is what seems to be like, hey, okay, he comes in from the... Well, sell me your birthright. If you're going to die, go ahead and sell me your birthright type of thing. Then I'll give you some soup. And then he comes later. And the whole idea of like, yes, there's a mama's boy element. He may have been strong as anything, but his mom's like, hey, I got an idea. How about you come do this? Like, oh, okay, I'll do that. And instead of going to Isaac going, whoa, whoa, he sold his birthright to me and that is mine, not his. No, we have to have this entire elaborate scheme where I'm going to put on clothes. There's no way you read that story and it comes out with him looking like the good guy. Esau was a moron. Esau was not a good guy. We know this. The Edomites are terrible. But Jacob does not come out of that story looking like a good guy in the least when he's tricking his father. Is that you, my son? Yep, it's me. Like, it's tough to get around. So, though I agree
I
with you.
I can see that, but on the other hand, it's like the, and not end justifies the means here, but the outcome is, that was the thing that was supposed to happen, the right thing. Because you also look at the blessing that Isaac was going to give him. Isaac was a terrible father.
I agree.
Isaac was not good. Because he is like... Esau, my love, you get everything, and your brother's going to serve you, and it's great. And
the
you
favoritism with it,
well,
with
yeah,
because Rebecca was bad.
Yeah, what was the other blessing you were going to give? Tough rocks, buddy. You know, life's going to be hard. Like that was what he saved for Jacob, and it's like, no, man, this is not cool. And
well,
so,
I love
you know,
what it
this
says.
Is...
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I love what it says though about Isaac, where it's like he loved his son because he loved game. The taste of game.
Right,
like,
yeah, they
like
the meat that he cooked, yeah.
That's why you liked Esau more than Jacob, is the guy who was a good hunter? Like, okay, buddy. So no, Isaac was a terrible father, and you're right. It goes back to the same thing as Abraham being blessed, or Abram at the time, being blessed for lying to Abimelech and then to Pharaoh.
Pharaoh,
like,
yeah.
Twice he lies about that, and he gets blessed both times, and the other guy's going to die. And so there's a element of like the friend of God, God is with him, even though we would look at that, and I do think that's just a horrible way of going about it. It is ultimately what was supposed to happen, and that's tough to get around to some degree that God
I do
still
think,
blesses him.
we got to move on. But I do think also his character gets a lot stronger once you get past that initial section there in chapters 27 and 28. Like, the way he kind of stands up to Laban and says, all right, man, enough. You know, I really
appreciate
the way he makes amends with Esau. Yeah, so... but then there's the other thing is that he seems to carry on the favoritism that his parents had with Joseph and Benjamin. Like, so obviously,
I don't think he was a good father.
You could nitpick all the old characters in the Old Testament, but that's an interesting one, Jack.
Look at his sons. I mean, he's raised 10 sons that are throwing another one into the pit, and Judah going to sleep with Tamar. Like, I don't think he's raised upstanding individuals across
the
board.
Basically, clearly telling them, "Hey, I like these two sons better than the other 10."
Right.
Like,
right.
Based
and
on who
mourning Joseph. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. So,
all right, we got to keep going. Joe, it's your turn for the next one. Yep.
My hot take is that I think we give David too much credit. We give David too much credit.
That's a scorching hot take.
That is a hot take.
And once again, recency bias, because I'm reading through David's life. Read through Saul's, reading through David's life right now. And we always like, oh, well, there's that one thing with David and Bathsheba. That wasn't good. That was kind of the blight on his character. The rest of it's really upstanding. Like, no, we have the census counting where he does it and he's not supposed to. Excuse me, we have him going and fighting alongside the king of Gath, a Philistine city, fighting alongside the Philistines for over a year. The guy talks about it, these months, and he says these years. So at least a year, maybe longer, sounds like, that he's living with the Philistines and fighting on their behalf. These are people that engage in child sacrifice. And he's hiding from Saul in their cities. And I understand the concept of hiding, but it's like, why in the world are you going to battle with them? To the point that the other Philistine commanders are like, excuse me? He's like, no, he's my guy. He's cool. He's got a vouch for him. Like,
isn't
this is a pagan
God,
king.
Like, speaking to him and blessing him in the midst of all that, though?
Once again, it's the same as Jacob. It's the same as Abraham, where we would look at it and go, what is going on? Even some of the things with David, like him killing, I just read 2 Samuel, or was it? Yeah, 2 Samuel 1, where he kills
the guy that killed Saul.
But the guy didn't really kill Saul. He put Saul out of his misery. And the way the text reads in 1 Samuel is that Saul basically fell on his own sword. And so Saul's just laying there like, ugh. And the guy comes and ends it for him, which is an act of mercy, in my opinion. Now, there's the Amalekite connection and things like that. There's a lot more going on, so I understand that. On the other hand, for him to take a young man and be like, go cut him down. Go kill him. Like, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. There seems to be enough. And when Saul is like ruining the kingdom, and he's ruling it ruthlessly and terribly, and he's got an opportunity, like, are those not opportunities given by God to do the right thing, which would be to kill the man that is taking Israel way to the side and into false worship and into battles and things like that they shouldn't be? Like, I don't know. It seems like in that moment, he's very concerned about not harming the king, but on the other hand, the king is harming everybody else. And in every other biblical story, the righteous thing to do would be to kill the evil king, such as Ehud with Eglon, as I referenced earlier. So, I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like a guy who's called the man after God's own heart's a pretty good guy. I guess that's my take.
I understand that, but I think it's he had a heart for God where he obviously from the Psalms and things like that, he had a heart for God. All I'm saying is the idea that there's just one mistake along the way. It's like I read through David's life and there are several mistakes along the way, and we hold him up as like, this is one of the greats. Like, there's a reason he wasn't able to build the temple. He was a man of massive bloodshed.
I think he is one of the greats, pretty clearly.
I don't think you can name
five characters in the Bible, specifically Old Testament, that are better examples.
But again, there's at least 4 to 5 questionable things in his story, at least, that you're looking at that we just kind of we move it on down. That doesn't really matter. Like, these are massive mistakes that would have gotten a lot of people killed, depending on it. But the fact that he's a man after God's own heart, God does kind of, that's tough to get around, but God does kind of wink at some of these things that I would look at and go, what?
He was in a tough spot, you know, for a lot of that. I would be harder on him later in life with his, you know, how he handled his own family.
Father. Yeah.
Well, and yeah, I was going to say
Amnon and Tamar. And
that whole situation is terrible.
Absalom took that on himself because David didn't handle it properly. And it was basically like, just don't bother me with that. And Absalom rose to power because he was listening to the people. He was an ear to the people where David had kind of outgrown that, I guess. And
you're building my case.
So, but I'm saying more on the backside. Then I get the stuff of like making allies that you don't necessarily want to have as allies when your life's threatened and all that. It's starting with Bathsheba where everything starts falling apart and he does the census and all that. But
still the man after God's own heart, still in heaven, and maybe he'll get to nitpick us someday and be like, well, why'd you do that?
Yeah.
That's true.
But,
Hey folks, you've probably heard us talk about Focus Plus and the Deep End. If you're wondering what that is, Focus Plus is our subscription service available through Patreon. Every week, members get all kinds of Christian content for your walk, including daily devotionals, a sermon of the week, and our understudied teaching series, which Joe and I lead through obscure and less covered books of the Bible like Leviticus and Revelation. We also have the Deep End, of course, which is our bonus segment exclusively for Think Deeper listeners, where you can submit your comments on an episode and we will respond and have a bit of a Q&A each and every week that drops every Friday. So if you're interested and want to know more, check that out. Go to patreon.com and search Focus Press, or go to focuspress.org/plus.
All right, I'll go quick with my last one. This is less of a character hot take and more of just, I might have shared this before. In Luke 16, rich man Lazarus, I am of the strong belief that that was a parable that Jesus told for a very specific reason. First of all, he starts it out just like he does dozens of other parables, is there was a certain, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how he starts parables, right? But the other thing is everybody says, well, it's not a parable because he gives, you know, Lazarus has a name. My response to that always is, it's the only name in the parable. Well, why doesn't the rich man have the name then? Like, wouldn't that have been a pretty easy thing to just, well, this guy's name was this. And I'm of the belief that the reason why Lazarus has a name in this particular parable is because, you know, at the end of the story, and I'll just read it here, you know, you have the rich man who says, hey, go tell my five brothers. I don't want them to end up in this place, essentially me paraphrasing. Verse 29, Abraham said to him, they have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them. And he said, no, Father Abraham, but if one goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But he said to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rise from the dead. What did Jack bring up earlier about Caiaphas when Lazarus was raised? Also, just a coincidence that that's the exact same name as the guy that Jesus raised from the dead, and then the Jewish leaders said, doesn't matter, we got to kill him anyway. I think Jesus was making a strong parallel here to him raising Lazarus from the dead, and the Jewish leader still saying, we don't care. It doesn't matter that you rose somebody from, or that somebody's raised from the dead, we're not going to listen. It's exactly what you see at the end of this parable. So, and that's why I think, again, the poor man is given a name here being Lazarus. Pretty strong parallel there with the guy that was raised from the dead by Jesus that elicited the same response in this particular story that the Jewish leaders had. So,
okay, this that, is about to get this take. This is very good because you know, I was looking something up, so you might have mentioned this. Did you mention Caiaphas's five brothers?
No, I did not.
Okay, that's something that people say that this was Jesus taking shots at him, Caiaphas himself, is that he had five brothers who also were priestly, were up there,
and there you go.
Or they were sons of Annas, so they were like in-laws, something like that. But he had five brothers and. So this one says, moreover, according to these scholars, the parable of the rich man Lazarus is directly connected to the story of the raising of Lazarus, both because the coincidence of names and these high priests as Sadducees denied the resurrection. The hellish fate of the rich man is connected to Caiaphas's role in the death of Jesus in this scenario. All right. I can go. That's pretty interesting.
That's very interesting. Very interesting.
So,
where I might, I don't know. I mean, that's pretty good. What are your thoughts on, like, Jesus never has a parable that is outside the realm of possibility? You know, like, that's he would make up a scenario as to how heaven works so as to have this. It seems like he works within the realm of reality. These things do happen, but it's, you know, he's just using one of parables taking these concepts, but every concept is grounded in reality. A sower is sowing seed. Like, that's not like, you know, a sower is I don't even know. Like, it would be he keeps it within the realm of things that happen. So even if it was a parable, do you think that's still, he's using ways that it still works up there? Or do you think he's coming
I see what you're saying. Like, essentially, is he making up the, like
the concept that there are, that, yeah, the chasm, there, correct, yeah. The map there.
Yeah. No, I don't think he's making it up. I mean, we've had episodes about kind of what happens after death. I think there's the question of, like, can the rich man in this, like, he could see Lazarus. Like, is that going to be the case where you can actually see the people or, you know, what? That I'm not sure. But, no, I would answer, I do think, you know, a lot of what's in the parable is probably, you know, literal in the sense of, like, yeah, it does exist. There is obviously a resting place, Abraham's bosom, right? Or there is torment. There are things like that. So, yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
So will people in hell be able to know that? You know, that their people aren't like, are they conscious of everything going on Earth?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. Because that's the other reason why a lot of people try to argue that this is not a parable, is because it's like, well, you know, that would mean paradise and torment are not real if this is a parable. Like, not necessarily, like you're saying, Joe, then Jesus could have just been using this as a... So, yeah, that would be... I was 60-40 on my other take. I'm like 90-10 on this one, I would say.
Interesting. Pretty
interesting.
All right, before we hit audience quick hits or commenter quick hits, any cutting room floor ones you want to throw out without any discussion?
I mean, I had as a backup that it's not a hot take, but Jephthah did kill his daughter. A lot of debate on that, where people think that, oh, it was her virginity. Nah, it wasn't.
Well, and then you can debate like the trappings around that. What, you know, was that right? Well, yeah, there's a lot around that.
Yes, child sacrifice. Yeah.
I did not have any, Jack. Do you have any? Okay.
Nehemiah should be an A-lister. He's kind of like a C-list Bible character, but I know his book's short. So is Daniel. So are some other, you know, Jonah's real short, but everyone knows him. Nehemiah.
Stud.
Great guy. Yeah. All right. So with these, we're going to read ones that people gave me in the comments. I told them I was going to maybe share some of them on the show. I'm going to read them. You give me a basic agree, disagree. So Cambry says, I hate that Samson is glorified to kids. He definitely wasn't someone to look up to. Agree, disagree.
I would agree overall.
Yeah. Will's 80-20. I would agree. Yeah.
I think there's there's obviously elements in his story of, you know, him putting his faith in God at the end to push the pillars down. But I mean, overall, like, womanizer, kind of gave up his strength just to please her, killed people. Like, yeah, not a
fan. But he's one of, like, John the Baptist with the Nazarite vow. He's one of two we see, I think. I could be off on that, but I think he's only one of two in the Bible that we see with the Nazarite vow as a pretty important figure. You know, like, that is any time that you're son's birth is told to you by angels, that's not insignificant. So I don't know what to make of that, because he does seem like a dirtbag in a lot of ways, but he's also a guy that the angels themselves are coming to his parents saying, you're going to have a special son. Yeah. I don't know.
You study the Samson Samuel parallels. That's an interesting study, because they're around and probably at the same time. All right. The problem
do you agree
is we got,
or disagree,
like,
Jack?
I'll go with you guys mostly agree. Like, I put him on my most annoying people list, and so, you know, it's so... the VBSification of some of these characters, like the one I gave as an example is that Jonah is not the good guy. Everyone, you know, as a kid, I thought, oh, Jonah, great guy. Maybe not. So, all right, we have 60 of these, so we're going to have to just do the agree, disagree. Sorry. Shamgar was a boss. Samson, basically 600 with a pointy stick is better than Samson's 1,000 with a donkey's bone. Agree, disagree. Shout out to Rob for that one.
Oh, man. I mean, I feel like the donkey bone 1,000 is more impressive, but with Shamgar, a cool guy, then yeah, sure, I'll agree.
Yeah, all right, cool guy. Okay, we got one here. Peter was the only one who stepped off the boat. We kind of talked about that. Let's see. We've got a couple on Doubting Thomas. One is that Doubting Thomas is an unfair name. This one, Tyler, so that was Keith. Tyler says, Thomas was heeding Jesus' warning that there would be imposters when he was hesitant until he saw Jesus with his own eyes. That's interesting.
That is
so
interesting.
So just kind of the package deal there. Are we too hard on Thomas with the Doubting Thomas name?
I think yes.
Yes.
Okay, agree. Moses had tremendous personal insecurity that bled into doubting God. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
David, pretty decent king overall, terrible father. I think we've mentioned that as well. Agree. All right, he's with me. Nehemiah should be more famous. I'm going to agree on that. Joseph, Daniel, and Nehemiah should be looked at as examples of how to serve as faithful men in a secular government. 100% agree. That's
great take.
You know,
yep.
That you can be a Christian in government and influence things well. Will, did you have a great disagree there?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
All right. Aaron says, Gideon was never a good judge. He's got a long comment, so you guys will have to go look it up on my Facebook, giving the textual argument for that. But again, Gideon gets a little VBSified. Agree or disagree, he was never a good judge.
I disagree.
Disagree. Right.
I think I know where he's coming from. You know, the whole ephod and things like that after. And
things get worse after the Midian defeat, yeah.
Correct. But anybody who's still willing to trust in God down to 300 against like 100,000, yeah, you're good in my book. I mean, if you got the guts to do that and the faith to do
there's a lot of negative about Gideon. I'm with you, Joe, as far as the faith in God. Yeah, I think overall he's one of the better judges. I'll put it that. I mean, there's a lot of bad judges, so but I still think there's a lot of negatives. So I think I will disagree slightly as well. I'll go 52-48 on that.
I'm gonna agree with him. All right, we had actually both sides of this one. One that Bathsheba was, to use a family friendly term, assaulted or violated, and then another one, Kaylin says Bathsheba is not necessarily the victim people claim she is. Which side of this are you guys on?
You already know, yeah. She is not the victim, everybody says.
She's absolutely not.
She's violated. Complicit. Right. She's complicit.
Yes.
Yeah, and well, by the law, the law manages how somebody is supposed to be tried for that, and it does not meet the specification.
She is supposed to scream out and, you know, in the city,
and
she doesn't.
He married her after that. Like, it seems like it was a. And she plays a role later on. Like, yeah, no, I don't think she. That's not the impression I get at all.
Well, you couldn't tell the king no. Like, I don't get the sense that's necessarily what's taking place. So maybe, but no, I don't think so.
All right, so we're with Kaylin on that. I'll find here in a minute who had the other side. Sorry about that. But all right, Sam says, in the book of Job, God never actually addresses anything said after chapter 3. I'd have to look at that a little closer, but I could
see
it.
Wait, say what now?
In the book of Job, God never actually addresses anything said after chapter 3. They have all that dialogue, and God comes back and is like, okay, but about this specific thing. I don't think I agree.
No, because doesn't God say something along the lines of, like, basically putting them in their place, the three in their place for...
He mentions, yeah, the three and the four friends, yeah.
Right, like,
Hot take with that is that what's the youngest guy's name? Not the Zophar Bildad.
Elihu.
That's it. Yeah. Is that he was the best one of those four.
Easily. Yeah. He was right, yeah. Anyway, that's a long conversation itself.
Yeah.
All right, JJ, I think Josiah was a great guy, but died in a stupid, avoidable way. There's a lot of that in the Kings. I'm going to agree with that. Asa, King Saul actually reacted to situations in the most human or normal way. His biggest problem was that when God seemed to take too long, he looked to the people for what to do instead of waiting on God.
Oh, I disagree.
Disagree.
There's a ton of reasons why. Yeah, I disagree. Dozens of things.
Read the first part of that again. What was the first part?
Saul reacted to situations in the most human and normal way.
Yeah, I think I disagree mostly with that.
Yeah, I disagree. Especially as the king.
Let me throw a spear at your head because I'm jealous that you're going to become king.
For a bipolar man who's like nuts out of his mind, sure. That's normal.
Even with the battles with people, like, it was he's a leader that did not have any leadership, you know, and so that's not a human normal, like, you don't have the luxury of doing, well, what are we supposed to do? So anyway. Kirk says, Jeroboam's primary flaw was not that he changed worship, as we often preach, but rather that he worshipped false gods with the golden calves, and, you know, he set it up so they didn't have to go to Jerusalem. I think it's both. I'd say both.
I haven't heard the argument, I guess, that he just changed worship and that's why it was wrong. I thought it was always idol-based.
I think some people make, like, their instrumental sermons based off of that.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, oh, he changed what was instructed kind of thing.
Who'd you say this was? I'm sorry?
Jeroboam.
Is he
the one that changed the location from Dan to Bethel or vice versa?
Because he didn't want them going to Jerusalem and falling back under Rehoboam, he brought it back up to northern
Israel. That's what it was,
All right, let's see. Rachel, our sister, shout out for the comment. Paul was not arrogant and gets a bad rap from people who don't understand how God was using his background and witness to reach an untouched people. Agree, disagree?
Joe first, please.
And where are you on this one?
I used to think Paul was incredibly arrogant. I think Paul is abrasive. I don't think he's arrogant now. I think he was very abrasive. I don't think he was I think more abrasive.
I think
abrasive.
He was intense. Intense
is a good word. Yeah, I think intense.
Yeah.
Growing up under like the Pharisaical, like, he was zealous, he was intense, and I think that just carried over into his Christianity.
Right. Tucker says, he linked a thing, and the headline comment said, Ruth did not sleep with Boaz, and I'm like, I'm pretty sure they did.
They were talking about uncovering
the foot. So I agree with that. Probably all agree with that. Joel says, we always talk about Peter's, like, we talked about, you know, Peter getting out of the boat, so we agree with that, sorry. Jason, the same about Samson and Solomon that we've talked about. This one, though, he says, the book of Ruth is as much about or more about Naomi than it is about Ruth. I agree. What do you guys think?
Based on, I think off the cuff, I disagree with that. What would that be based off of?
It starts with her. The child at the end is, like, given to her, you know, because it is the continuation of her lineage, and it's God taking away from her but restoring to her and using Ruth and Boaz. But, like, it's ultimately about her family.
But Ruth is the driver of basically everything that happens in that book, right?
Right, but in that it, like, there's more about Ruth, but it's coming back under the head of, you know, the heading of Naomi and family, and her bitterness being turned to joy and all of that, and, you know, God redeeming the family, all those things. So I would agree with that one. Joe?
I think I would agree. I've heard there's, like, a chiastic structure in Ruth, and that Naomi is... at the center, center point. Yeah, is the center point. And obviously the start and end is with her, like you're saying. And so, yes, I think I would agree.
All right, Roy says, Manasseh was mostly bad, but a good king in the end, whereas his father was mostly good, but selfish in the end. There is a lot of that, guys that don't finish well, but guys that repent, you know. So I mean, you even see Ahab do a little better towards the end, even though, so anyway. Let's see, this one was a question that I discussed on there, so let's see. Okay, another question. Sarah says, Vashti, a disobedient wife or a virtuous queen? That's a great question.
That's a really good one. that's a great one. Go ahead, Joe.
I don't think so. I think it's your turn.
I think it's your turn.
Man, it's kind of same as the Bathsheba question of, like, you know, how much could she push back? Because if you say Bathsheba was violated, then yes, Vashti was absolutely violated. If you say Bathsheba, you know, like, there's a similarity to that of how much could she have pushed back to the king?
And well, give the context of why it would have been, like, why she might have been in the right for disobeying the king is because she was almost certainly going to be paraded around the throne room naked, essentially.
That's the claim that some people make. Maybe. And if so, then yeah, that's not great. On the other hand, like, these are not virtuous peoples. And so it's, I would say that there could be a little bit of both in that, but sure, you know, yeah, like, of, this is what non-virtuous people, like, in the context of you're already not virtuous people, and this is what you signed up for when you became the queen to not, but I don't, there's a lot there. That, the whole Esther thing, we kind of need to do a deep dive on that someday. Cause one of the hot takes we didn't get to was Mordecai and, you know, whether he was a good guy or not, and whether he was the main character of Esther, kind of like Naomi with Ruth. And anyway, so yeah, we don't really have time to get into that, but that's a very interesting question.
I think I would lean more towards the disobedient wife.
Okay, let's set that aside, and we got to jump the one here next. Let's set these on our next Q&A episode. I'll make a note of that. Because somebody makes the point about Jephthah, depending on your interpretation. This is Hayden, says, he's either a horrible pagan who sacrificed his daughter or an incredibly faithful man who kept his word to God with an irrational vow, and she knew her, she remained virgin and not sacrificed. So what actually happened with Jephthah? We might have talked about that before. It's been 220 episodes, so we can do it again. Let's see. Carter says the prophet Jeremiah is a lot more intricate than the whining prophet a lot of people know him as. I wouldn't say he's a whiner. Weeping prophet, fair, but not whining. I agree. Eric says all the first three patriarchs were terrible husbands. That's pretty hard to disagree with. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Is that, I'm guessing, due to the polygamy? Isaac was not a polygamist, was he?
No, he was not. Yeah, but this division over of what we talked about earlier with Esau and Jacob, yes, and they're on separate sides of it. Obviously, you got Abraham listening to his wife and taking Hagar and splitting the family and, right, you know, just kind of happy wife, happy lifing it. And then Jacob with the multiple women and the rivalry. So I would get with this one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Isaac might have the most functional with Rebecca, though I don't think he's a good guy.
We just don't have that much. We don't have that much glimpse at it.
Yeah, but we don't see him sleep with anybody else. We see him sticking to him and Rebecca.
The monogamous one, yeah.
The monogamous one, but yeah, I don't know.
All right, Jacob agrees with Joe that Jonah died in the belly of the whale.
Hang on. We got to go back. Go back to the patriarch one for a second. Read that again, that they were terrible husbands.
Yeah, all three. So how would we get her?
Obviously, we've had the polygamy. I think that's a separate thing. As opposed to were they good to their wife?
No, I don't. It's not the polygamy that I'm holding up. It's,
well,
Abraham listened to his wife to have this other kid, and that was a really big problem. And
he also gave his wife away twice.
Yeah, saying she's my sister, and sure. And then the Jacob thing is the, and I know it wasn't his fault that he ended up with two different wives, you know, but
right,
he didn't manage that well. And
well, then the concubine thing too. Well.
Yeah.
How would we deal with then if that's going to be the thesis that they were terrible, all three of them were terrible husbands? These are the pillars of, you know, righteous men in the Old Testament from God.
And for that, goes to the development of Genesis, where like they all get a little bit from Cain and Abel and everything, well, and Adam and Eve, and all the way down to where Joseph is finally like, hey, we're starting to get better at this stuff.
Maybe my beef is with the word terrible. I don't know that I would say that they were flawed husbands. They were definitely flawed. For sure.
All right. Touré, he's got a few. One of them is irrelevant, but still interesting. Jacob can beat anyone in a fight. That's pretty funny. Jesus didn't throw the stone in John 8:1, the adulterous woman, not necessarily because he was showing mercy, but for thinking about it strictly from the human perspective, it was because he could not throw the stone. He had to be perfectly within the jurisdiction of the law. Yeah, I don't think he could have thrown the stone, but you know, there's a lot bigger discussion there. He says, we have no idea what demons are. We don't know if they're fallen angels or whatever it was. Again, a very deep one there, but I don't know about no idea, but I would agree somewhat. What do you guys agree, disagree?
I think I would disagree with that take. And the reason that I do think they're fallen angels, and the reason why is, where else would they have come from? Everything was created good. If you say there's demons, that means God, either Satan can create, we know that's not true, or God created evil people. And so they have to be something that initially started as good and went bad. Whether you want to say that's angels or whatever else, I do think that that's God cannot create against good. Something that's not good. So,
yeah.
I'm with Joe. I'm with Joe.
All right. Jenny says, Abraham, you know, we talk about his great faith. The man lied twice to save his life, and he was somewhere where God didn't send him based on the text because he didn't have enough faith that God would protect him. I feel that one's more complicated. I'm more disagree on that than most people would be. Where are you guys?
Would you read that one more time, Jack? I'm sorry.
God, about Abraham lying twice, we say he has great faith. He lied, and he went somewhere where God didn't send him because he didn't have faith in God's protection. So Abraham didn't have as much faith as we usually say.
I mean, referred to in the New Testament so much about his faith, about the faith that he had. So I get what she's saying. Like, I'm not trying to, like, you know, cast aspersions on that. But,
yeah,
I mean, I don't know. That's a tough one.
I think he had faith in the areas that sounds bad to say the areas that mattered. I don't know that he connected the whole sister-wife thing to a faith discussion. We do. I don't know that he would have to give him the benefit of the doubt. I don't know that I agree with this.
Right. The other thing, and I told Joe this earlier, like, we've got 100 and however many years of this guy's life, and we're getting, like, glimpses of, like, 12 days of it, you know, and so, but that is a pretty big thing that happened. Ernie says Adam was created mortal. I agree with that.
Hang on, what?
Created
Adam
mortal?
Adam was created mortal.
As opposed to?
Immortal. Like, he was not going to die until.
Oh, I see.
Sin.
Because of the tree of life thing.
Yeah. That if it was access to the tree of life that would keep him going. Yeah.
Right. The access, the tree of life could, but I think
he was taken away.
Yeah.
So we agree on that one. This one, I know there's a take Ernie has. He says, Enoch, Noah, Job, and Joseph lived sinless lives. Strongly disagree. I think you make case
Noah?
That's...
Wait, Noah? Did he say Noah?
Yeah.
I don't think Noah makes the list? Just because it uses that word? Because Noah, it says he was perfect in his generations or blameless in his generations, but I mean, you literally have the drunkenness scenario.
Yeah, but you could say, well, that hadn't been commanded yet. I don't know. Anyway, let's see. Eric was the one that had the other side of the David one, so I mentioned that earlier. Deb,
we got more comments than I realized.
Yeah, Deb adds this. She says, it seemed like Joseph never sinned. We just covered that a little bit. Jeremiah, his hot take is that Job did, in fact, sin. Pretty interesting. What do you guys think of that?
I mean, overall,
I thought the text,
I think sin, but
yeah,
in the
question, like in the book,
right? In
the book, challenging God.
I disagree with that.
I thought there was a verse in there that basically said that he, in all these things, he did not
remain blameless. He's building the case on basically at the end of the book, Job kind of repents in a way of like, oh yeah, I shouldn't have said that. And like, that's true. That doesn't mean he sinned.
And God does. Yeah, there's an important distinction. I mean, God does reprimand him pretty severely in those three chapters. But
But the reprimand is not based off sin. It's based off of, who are you to question me? David questions God all the time. Where are you? Right. Why is this happening? Like, and we don't get the sense
Well, then that would elicit the question, why didn't David get that same response that Job did?
Right. He also adds, Elihu was a prophet of the Lord. We kind of mentioned that earlier. I think we agree with that. Whether he was a prophet or not, he was right. Let's see, another person, the other side of that thinks, and he says, Paul was kind of a tool. Grant says that, so I don't think many of the early apostles or disciples liked his personality.
I don't
know. John, Mark, and Barnabas.
That feels a little blasphemous to me. I'm not.
I go back to that, like, you don't get to criticize Mr. Paul the Apostle. Yeah.
And then finally,
he gets Christina. Up to heaven. Paul's like, "What did you say about me?" Right, exactly. Right.
I oppose Grant to his face in front
yeah.
of all
because he was to be blamed. Yeah,
sorry, Grant. Christina. We get a lot of examples of unfaithfulness over generations. Aaron, Eli, David, for example. We don't see many detailed accounts of consistent multi-generational faithfulness.
I don't know. That we see.
Agree
any.
Or disagree?
I agree.
The
Rectifies
is always agree. That interesting one where they kept what yeah. the father had. Said about the alcohol and the living in tents, but that's the only one. And obviously there's no major character in that, so right. that's the only one that comes to mind.
I will say, obviously, Aaron had Nadab and Abihu, and they're the famous ones. He also had Eleazar.
Eleazar, like, yeah.
Really good guy, took over as high priest. And so, you know, that's not good that it was just some of them and not all of them, but there's at least a little bit of lineage there and succession and all that. You wonder, like, what happened to Moses' kids? That's always weird right. to me. Like, it's Joshua and Caleb. Why were Moses? And I know it wasn't supposed to be like a dynasty or anything, but still, it's kind of strange.
It is interesting going back to the terrible husbands thing that we kind of disagreed upon. It does seem like, man, a lot of the just hallmark Mount Rushmore guys in the Old Testament could not disciple their kids to righteousness.
Even the good kings have terrible kids almost yeah. every time. You know, is it Jehoshaphat yeah. that has Joash? No, who's the one? There's one that has, and one of them ends badly, I believe.
Yeah, he starts okay.
Badly.
Yeah,
Joash started yeah. okay and ended badly. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's
yeah.
the one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot
it hardly
of
ever
negative.
Happens. Yeah,
yeah. All right, man, that was really cool. We appreciate all the
Thanks,
comments.
Guys.
That was like you said, Will. That was a lot of them. We got to all of them. So thank you everybody who dropped a comment in there. And we want to hear your hot takes. If you didn't get one of those comments in, drop it in the comments here on YouTube, Facebook, Focus Plus, wherever you are. Again, we'd also like your list of best person, worst person, best hang, most annoying. Anything you got, drop it in the comments. You can support us over at focuspress.org and follow us over there. And that's all we got. We will talk to you guys on the next one.
Hey guys, Jack Wilkie here. If you enjoy our work with podcasts like Think Deeper and Godly Young Men and our books, articles, seminars, and want to support the work that we do, the best way to do so is to go to focuspress.org/donate. That's focuspress.org/donate. Thanks again for listening.